Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. How are you listening to me right now? Your cell phone, your car radio, or another device? There are so many different ways sound can travel, something we recently learned at the Vintage Radio and Communications Museum in Windsor, Connecticut. Inside the warehouse-style building, there are rows of different devices displayed chronologically from the 1800s to today. I'm talking about typewriters and teleprinters, record players and stage lighting, and oh, so many phonographs, radios, and record players. There's also an amateur radio station. It monitors the local broadcast band, a colorful live graph of spikes and dips showing radio waves in the area. Later this hour, we'll hear from one of the museum's amateur radio operators, or HAMs. You can join us for that segment, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WNPR, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. But first, take a tour with us. This hour, you'll hear me and producer Katie Pellico in conversation with four different museum volunteers. John Ramos is one of them. He's been with the museum for 3 years. He's got his first Build Your Own radio set when he was 9.
I came back to Connecticut from Pennsylvania 17 years ago and retired. And my wife wanted me out of the house for a little bit and sent me here. My background is in electrical and mechanical engineering. So this was sort of natural for me. Remember, I came from an era where I could go out on trash day, get a television or a radio, disassemble it. That's how I learned. That's how I learned I had an interest in electronics. I can't do that anymore. Everything's so miniaturized, you need a few hundred dollars worth of equipment.
Inside the museum, John brought us back to the 1840s and showed us a telegraph.
Of course, Morse code is real, where we really got started. Samuel Morse, 1840, came up with Morse code, the idea of using, we'll call them dots and dashes to represent letters and numbers. This is about 1880. This is a typical Morse code station of the day. This would have been in every train depot. This would have followed the Intercontinental Railway, first practical way to communicate across the United States. The telegrapher had a key and a sounder. They would use the key, manipulate the key, to send Morse code. Now, what you're listening for is the difference between a dot and a dash, three times longer. They tell me there's guys that could watch the bar to read this. I will never be one of them. We all have accents. So did they. They could tell each other apart from their cadence when they sent. Now, of course, this is wired telegraphy. You can see the wires. In fact, if you could, see that key over there to the right? Tap that a couple of times.
This one?
Yep. We have a two-station Morse code system. We can send messages to and from each other. Most of us are amateur radio operators. Mm-hmm. There's still a few guys that regularly use Morse code. In fact, I learned Morse code in the 70s. Used to be the Associated Press would send their articles from Europe about 4 o'clock in the morning using Morse code. I think it was cheaper than sending it by the cable. A lot of times those guys were too fast for me, but it worked.
But it worked. John said this a lot on our tour, as he explained different technological advances, like a 1921 tuned radio frequency receiver.
You even had to have some lead acid cells to run the filaments. You would have had to take those down to your local pharmacy or garage once a week and get them charged. But it worked.
He also showed us a 1928 RCA radio.
And you still needed to get a speaker. You still had to rig up some kind of antenna, but it worked.
Another thing that worked, crystals. these naturally occurring elements were used to conduct radio waves starting in the 1890s.
Over here, you would use galena, naturally occurring mineral. Usually it would be put in a little lead puck. And you can see that rod above it has a spring on it. It's called a cat's whisker. You would keep touching the cat's whisker to the crystal until you heard a radio station. Now, our collection here, there are kits, there are homemade, there are factory made. Date myself horribly right now. That Fillmore Little Wonder, I got mine when I was 9. There are lots of things that can rectify an alternating current signal. Some older gas stoves, for example, you can actually blow out the flame. A flame will actually rectify alternating current. It knew it was blown out. It would try to restart itself. We've got some razor blades over here. Why do we have razor blades in a collection of crystal sets? During World War II, GIs found that the coating on a Schick razor blade was an excellent radio detector. You'd use a small piece of lead, and they built foxhole radios out of it. Now, if you want to even take a step back further, this is a coherer. This predates all the crystal sets. You've got a bunch of metal filings, usually iron filings, in a vacuum. It could actually detect the electromagnetic pulses from this transmitter. It would ring the bell because once this was tripped, you had to knock it. And that's what the bell was for. It was actually to knock it so it could receive the next signal. These could receive Morse code. But yes, the crystal set is more formal. There are no batteries. It's working off the power of the broadcast signal. We're talking on the order of 100,000th of a volt at the antenna. That's why we can get about 3 stations on that set over there. They have to be close. They have to be relatively powerful. That crystal set is working over there, if you want to give it a shot.
I put on a pair of headphones and could faintly hear WTIC through the crystal set. Another volunteer with the museum, Skip Colson, described the setup.
This rock, for whatever reason, the lead inside it has the ability to take out of the air the energy that radio stations put into the air, especially AM radio stations. So we take a very small piece of it, about the size of your little finger, and have a little tiny wire and move it around on that piece of rock, have an antenna and earphones, no battery, no electricity, and you can hear a radio station. And we literally have one right here. This has been running 24/7 for probably the past 10 years. You'd have to listen very, very, very carefully to hear a voice inside. That's what got me going in ham radio. My uncle gave me a crystal set. I had antennas all over the yard and everything.
You can easily build crystal sets yourself. John said museum volunteers will often host workshops for local schools.
Now, last year we built 175 kits with children probably from about 7 to 12 years old. We are going to have some class for older children. They're going to be building an FM radio, some things like that. Yeah, I mean, the younger kids with the crystal sets, it's about 1.5 hours, 2 hours. They get some instruction on how it's working, tailored to their ages. And they walk out of here with something that works. There's a sense of accomplishment. They have wound the coil in it. They've assembled the whole thing. Quite frankly, the director and I make sure you walk out of here with a working radio by the time you leave. You can use it at home. We just hope it gets a spark, gives the kids an idea. What we try to do is make them realize that the internet runs off radio. We try to make them realize how important radio is in their everyday lives.
During the tour, we learned about the history of radio and communications, but also the big role advertisers played in marketing technological advances to the public. One brand mascot stuck out to us, a little black and white terrier with his snout to a phonograph horn. Peter Knight, another volunteer, explained.
The dog has a name. His name is Nipper. It's an early advertising piece for the Victor company. And there's an original story, which I do not think is true. I think
I think it's true.
Yeah, I don't know if this is true, but you can see the picture in the back there of Nipper. And that's with a very early phonograph. It might be a Berliner phonograph on top of a flat table type surface. And that flat table type surface was, according to the legend, and maybe real, was a coffin. And you know that Victor's motto was his master's voice. And so the idea behind that was, so I think somebody took a picture of that and tried to use the advertising for Thomas Edison. This is something where the dog is listening to his master's voice and he's got his nose in the horn and he's feeling really bad that his master's gone. And he hears his master's voice over the phonograph. And so the story was that Thomas Edison said, oh, no, that's too macabre for me. So anyway, they took it. They ended up taking it to the Victor Company, and the Victor Company accepted the idea, but they wanted to get rid of the coffin idea. So you can see it's on a table right there, but you can't tell that it's a coffin. But that's the story.
So during that era, with advertising being so out there and having people trying to inspire people to buy the Victrola, so did people buy the Victrola? Like, did
these were widely sold. After that one, they started going away. This thing called radios coming along started influencing sales on these.
Radio came on the scene in the 1890s, less than 15 years after the invention of Nipper's beloved phonograph.
Why Nipper? Why was he called Nipper? He used to nip people. It's always the simple explanation.
And I think Nipper likes this phonograph the best. This is called a Victor Orthophonic phonograph. And as far as 78 phonographs, this is by far the best sounding phonograph of the era. It has a horn that's built into the cabinet. It's a wooden horn, and the horn has all different shapes and sizes and expands as it comes out. So it takes the music and essentially amplifies it. That's a very simple way of describing it, but of all the phonograph horns, this one is actually the best. And it took a lot of trial and error in engineering to come up with a phonograph that sounds as good as this. In fact, I can play it for you if you'd like.
You've been listening to Peter Knight, John Ramos, and Skip Coulson, volunteers at the Vintage Radio and Communications Museum in Windsor. We'll continue the tour after a quick break. And later this hour, we talk ham radio. Amateur radio operators, we want to hear from you. Call 888-720-9677, 888-720-WNPR, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. This hour, we're touring the Vintage Radio and Communications Museum in Windsor, Connecticut. Before our break, we left off at the turn of the 20th century, just as radio came onto the scene. The museum is filled with radios from all different decades. There's even one case dedicated to novelty radios, disguised as a WD-40 can, Snoopy, and a cigarette box. Museum volunteer Skip Coulson led us into a room with recording equipment posed around a set of chairs and a small table.
This room is a recreation of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, early 50s sound room where they did broadcasts, be it a soap opera, be it a mystery, be it whatever. One of the very famous War of the Worlds, 1938, they were doing a science fiction story. Well, the story got the public that was listening thinking it was a real invasion of these spaceships from Mars, and they were all running around. Eventually, the police came into the studio and said, what are you guys doing? And they said, we're just putting on a radio program. He said, you better make an announcement that this is just a story. And they would have in this room a organ for music. But this table over here is the sound effects table. Hey, it's cold outside. Close the door. Give me your money or I'll shoot you. Look out for the kid on the bicycle. Frog. But this one is my favorite. You have to listen very, very carefully to guess what the sound is.
Skip pressed his hands into a bag.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford Healthcare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Bag of baking powder.
Snowshoes?
Shoes walking in snow. When I do tours, very few people guess walking in snow. So this was how it was done. People would be standing in front of the floor microphones with their pieces of paper in their hand, be it a mystery, be it a soap opera, be it whatever, and they would have the sound effects. In the room next door would be the engineer's control room. And we literally have had theater groups come in and put on Gracie and Alan comedy, maybe a mystery, maybe a soap opera. And we would be able to record and control everything. So they had a very, very good time. But a big display of microphones up near the ceiling. The sound of thunder. A little bit crude, but it did the job back in the days of radio when people listened to radios. Now people have the TV or their iPhones or whatever.
Volunteer Jeff Gross also shared what he thinks we're missing with cell phones.
Well, one thing I find fascinating is you think about mentioning the cell phone. Your cell phone actually has about 5 different radios in it. Yeah.
It's very complicated.
It's very complicated. One of them is for talking. One of them is the GPS. One of them is involved with picking up your Wi-Fi. So altogether, they have about 5, some of them have even more, 5 different radios in there, each of which does its own thing.
Volunteers fielded our many questions about the differences between analog and digital recordings, like a vinyl record versus a Spotify track. People think different devices might degrade the sound quality, but John settled the debate.
What it really comes down to is if your source material is digital or analog. You want analog source material that's been imposed onto the analog record. The digital source material, for as accurate as it is for all the sampling, high sampling rates and such, it's muddy. You will not hear the instruments like you just heard them here, the depth. They refer to it as the depth of the sound stage. So what we were just listening to is an analog source material that was recorded in an analog fashion and impressed on an analog vinyl record. A lot of the new vinyl you can get is digital source that's been impressed on a vinyl record. It just doesn't sound the same. It doesn't have the depth of the sound stage that this does. What you're hearing on your phone has been sampled at a very, very high rate. It's pretty accurate. The computer that's regenerating the audio, they're usually very good in terms of curve fitting and replacing, but you still have to remember it's a digital source. The original analog source was an amplitude modulated wave. What you're getting on your phone is basically a square wave that's been smoothed into it. I am still amazed at how well our phones can reproduce sound, because usually you can see the size of these speakers. Usually you need a bigger speaker, you're moving air. And that those phones work the way they do amazes me.
Is it the same with laptop or computer speakers?
Same. Yeah. Basically you're coming down to how, for good reproduction, you're moving air. The more air you can move, the better it's going to sound.
And what about car radios today, too?
Same thing. I mean, if you listen to a lot of the satellite radio systems, heavily compressed. In fact, if you listen, if you know your source material well enough, you can actually hear errors in the compression algorithms. Because it's, again, it's a digital piece that's being converted to analog in the car radio. So the way our ears work, we're hearing the highest amplitude sound, the loudest sound, so to speak. What's happening when you digitize things, again, you're only picking out the highest. Sometimes you're not getting some of the nuances that you can get here. And I think that's what causes makes it a little muddy.
Can you talk about the nuances?
It all comes down to the software that's driving it.
Well, I think one of the biggest problems is that most people now aren't listening to CDs. They're listening to MP3s. And there's no question that the compression that they use to make an MP3 reasonably sized so that you can send it to your cell phone or listen to it on your little device, it loses some of the sound. On the other hand, those of us who grew up with vinyl, that had problems too. Every time you play it, you kind of degrade the tracks. In addition, if there's any dust on the record, the needle tends to compress the dust into the track. And the next time you play it, you'll hear the little pop. And then another little pop. And after a while, you get so many pops, you can't use the record anymore. Whereas with a CD, the sound is always good. For decades, you can play it over and over again. The sound quality will not change. So those of us when I remember getting my first CD player in 1984 or so, and boy, the sound was so much better than my vinyl records because of the fact that you didn't have all those pops and crackles from playing the record over and over again.
And I think this is just anecdotal and subjective, but can you guys talk about why are people interested going back to vinyl when CDs may have a better quality?
I've always heard the warmth of the sound.
All audio people say that. There's warmth of the sound, and somehow they feel that the bass is fuller. I don't know.
On the other hand, if you actually have people do a blinded trial, they really can't tell. They really can't tell.
Volunteers like Jeff and John Ramos keep the museum running. Owner John Ellsworth says the museum doesn't rely on federal funding. Our tour guide, John, explained the big role the museum plays in the small network of radio parts sellers in the U.S.
We have a collection of tubes, probably more than 100,000 back there. We use them to restore our equipment. We're one of the only ones left, really, that sells them for restoration purposes. It's getting hard to find these things. They're no longer domestically made. Some of the more contemporary tubes are made in Eastern Bloc nations and such.
A lot of older parts that we have that are still good. A lot of people learn about the Radio Museum and they decide they want to donate things. So a lot of people will come to us and say, I have a bunch of parts. And so we'll tell them to send a photograph to our website. Then we decide to go pick up the parts if we need them, radios and parts. That's pretty much how we survive because we're a total nonprofit. And so a lot of the parts we have in the back are from people who just heard about us and contacted us.
Can you talk about how often people come in and reach out and want to get the tubes or get things fixed?
I think I'm generally sent. Well, we don't repair here. The one time, Peter knows better than I, but I think the one time we tried to repair here, we had a 2-year backlog. There's a couple of people that we refer to. But we have a couple of tube orders a week, plus our own internal usage.
So very active?
I would think so.
Yeah, as far as repair is concerned, yeah, we can't take that on because we just have so many things going on here. This is kind of a work in progress and always will be. But we have a couple of people who do that, who actually do that for a living, and we can refer you to them.
Our tour continued through the 1900s and early 2000s. We asked John to tell us what visitor traffic is like at the museum.
2,500 last year. Okay. And it's been increasing at a pretty steady pace. About 65% were from Connecticut. The rest were a lot of Massachusetts. We've even had some international visitors. We're very lucky. We're very close to the airport. A lot of people find us and have a couple hour layover. They end up here.
Well, that's what I asked you, like, you saying that it's one of the only radio and antique radio museums, really, it's kind of an obvious question, but why is it important to have this space here?
To tell the history of communications. Quite frankly, there's so many kids these days that don't know what a radio is, they don't realize this is a radio. They don't realize that the internet is using mostly radio to communicate with. We just want to keep the history of it alive.
You know, when you share that knowledge, you know, the fact that our cell phones that we have in our pockets are radio, what are their reactions?
They're very surprised, actually.
John moves over to a 90s era payphone that reminds me of Clark Kent.
Actually, the more fun we have, I'm going to be honest with you, 10 and 12 year olds. Now, please, I'm not trying to be ageist. You know what that is. The 10 and 12 year olds don't. That is from 42nd Street, New York. I don't know the provenance on this guy. They can call each other. I have to admit, I'm a little mean with the 10 and 12 year olds because they don't know how to use this. You tell them to dial 26. No, you have to pick up the receiver first. No, you have to leave it hung up until it rings. Mm-hmm. You watch them 2-6. No, you have to pull it down. It's just so much fun.
And for young people, the telephone section is probably the most fascinating section because we have things wired in here so we can actually call people into each one of these, the phone booth and the phone station over there. So kids love it.
And we're also pretty sure that Superman used to use this particular one.
I love that you say that because I was just going to reference. I know I'm in a good space when you went there. Yeah.
Well, you know something, there's a lot of things to be excited about because people will come in and sometimes people will start off and they're not interested in a section. Then all of a sudden you get to a section, like let's say someone in their 70s and you get into the 1930s section and they'll say, hey, my mom and dad had this radio. And especially if the radio is functional, you turn it on and they hear it and you just see their eyes pop out of their head because like, wow, I remember that radio. I had that exact same radio or one very similar to it. So there are all different sections of this museum where that can happen. So all different age groups can see things that they're interested in. Like I said, the kids love the telephone section.
Well, I had that moment earlier seeing the colorful Mac laptops, and I feel slightly ancient at this moment.
So. Well, so do I.
You know, I think everyone has mentioned this. The reality that we all have a piece of radio in our pockets or our bags these days. And it's a very quote simple device, right? Can you talk about shaking your head? Can you talk about why is it important to know that it all kind of started here? You know, it all kind of started in the 1800s and leading up to today.
Well, you know something, that's a really good question. I think it's important for people to know where things came from. And this goes from the chronology of telegraph that pretty much started in 1844 and goes all the way through, like you said, the early computer era. And so it just shows how things have developed so that when someone picks up their cell phone, they realize the world didn't just start with a cell phone. It took many, many years, you know, 150 years or more to get where we are today.
We had a hard time making it back out the door without stopping at a row of jukeboxes.
Go ahead, pick a song. This is 1940s. Go ahead and pick something.
Jingle, jangle, jingle seems to be the jangle today.
Okay.
So that's three.
Press the number. Now hold down that red button for a couple of seconds. Harder. Okay. And here we go. Swings the record out. Comes and picks it up. Playing it up here. This is playing 78s. Of course, it has a tube-based amplifier. It can only play one side of the record.
You've been listening to volunteers and tour guides John Ramos, Peter Knight, Jeff Gross, and Skip Colson. Learn more about the Vintage Radio and Communications Museum of Connecticut, plan your visit, and see photos from our tour at ctpublic.org/where we live. Coming up, we hear from Lisa Kirk, a museum volunteer who specializes in ham radio, or amateur radio operation. Fellow hams, give us a call. Dial 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WNPR. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
Oh, ain't you glad you're single? And that song ain't so very possible. Oh, Lily Bell, oh, Lily Bell, oh, Lily Bell, oh, Lily Bell. Though I may have done some fooling, this is why I never fell. I got burned, that jingle, jingle, burned.
That jingle,
and I go riding merrily. glad you're single. Oh, and that song ain't so very far from wrong. Oh, Marianne, so we done some moonlight walking, this is why I up and ran. I got bird, that single thing, that bird, that single thing, and I go riding merrily, I don't know, riding merrily, and the bird.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. This hour, we're touring the Vintage Radio and Communications Museum in Windsor. There, a group of volunteers also meets to talk ham radio, or amateur radio operation, that is. And joining me now to share what drew her to hamming is Lisa Kirk, who's a volunteer and ham radio operator at the Vintage Radio and Communications Museum in Windsor. Thank you so much, Lisa, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And ham radio enthusiasts, we want to hear from you. Give us a call, 888-720-9677, or leave us a comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So have to ask you the big question first, Lisa. Why is it called ham radio?
Nobody actually knows.
Well, this is a little awkward. Do we have any idea where it might come from?
No, but it's very early in the hobby. So, you know, people have little theories, but nobody knows the real answer.
That's so fascinating. So we actually asked this question to Skip, and he had one theory. Let's take a listen.
As near as we can figure out, the very, very early days of vaudeville, some performer screwed up his lines or tripped on the stage or something like that. They called him a ham. Whether that's true or not, I'm not quite sure. Nobody really knows the exact derivation.
Okay, so Skip basically echoed you as well, Lisa, but do you think that's possible?
Absolutely. I think that's pretty reasonable because it's around that time frame that the name got attached.
That's so interesting. And so, well, we'll continue to dig into that mystery as we go along. But can you talk about when did you become a ham?
So I became a ham in 1979 when I was 14 years old. And do you want to know how that happened?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay.
Whatever you like to share.
My parents gave me a CB radio for Christmas when I was 13. Mm. And I got on the air with that. I had a big antenna on the house, which I'm still stunned they let me put up. But it really whet my appetite, but it wasn't quite enough. I wanted to talk around the world. And the town of Windsor had an ad in the paper for a ham radio class run by the Civil Defense Department. And I, of course, wasn't old enough to drive, so I kind of begged rides to and from, and that got me on the air with ham radio.
So you had ambitions for bigger antennas, essentially.
Yeah, I'm putting up an antenna in my side yard soon, which is 135 feet long. So luckily, I have a big yard.
That's exciting. And when did you get involved with the museum?
I only got involved with the museum about a year and a half ago. And friends had been pushing me to go to the museum for years. And then finally, my cousin's husband said, they have a ham club. And no one had mentioned that before. So I went there that day and joined the ham club that day.
And you've been in that space for such a long time. And I'm sure things have sort of changed, or maybe they haven't changed really. But what would you say that this experience has added to your life?
Oh, well, you know, for me, it's especially in the museum, it's a place to meet and talk with a lot of friends and share knowledge. I'm getting knowledge from them. They're not getting knowledge from me. So
I doubt that, Lisa. We're learning so much in this space, by the way.
Oh, good. The museum gives me a place to hang out with people. Mm-hmm. And at the time that I joined the museum, I lived alone and in a big house, and just kind of sat there and watched TV, wondering what to do next. And now the museum has given me that space.
Well, us visiting the space, we can definitely feel the warmth coming out from it, just like a vinyl record, I suppose. We definitely felt the warmth when we were there during the tour. And just really quickly here, I want to share Mary Hobart from Newington told
the American Radio Relay League, or ARRL, that ham radio is a reflection of our world in miniature. And so many fascinating people from all walks of life who are on the other end of the line. Do you agree about this, you know, describing the community?
Absolutely. It's really diverse in terms of what people's backgrounds are. And there, you know, you would think there are a lot of people who are electrical engineers. And while that's true, there are certainly people who've done nothing like that and come from all walks of life.
Can you give us some examples or a range, maybe?
Well, certainly I know someone who's just getting their ham license whose family owns a hardware store. So not technical at all and starting from scratch. And there are hams at the museum that are not technical that started from scratch. They decided to get into the hobby without knowing any electronics or anything like that. One of them was a nurse. And, you know, it's been just great because anybody can do it. Even one thing I'd like to point out, it's not driven by mobility. So people who are disabled or people who are getting older can take up ham radio. It opens their world up to people around the world, and they don't need to worry about their mobility impacting their ability to use a ham radio.
And just a quick reminder for our listeners that we want to hear from you. If you have any experiences or you're thinking about joining the ham radio community, let us know, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I'm going to take a quick call. We have Jane on the line. Jane, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, Jane.
Yeah, my dad had a... He was a ham radio operator before he got into ham radio before he went into World War II, and he came out and he was an amateur radio operator for the rest of his life till he passed away in 89.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Jane. Lisa, I just heard from Jane who shared her story with us. Is that something that you hear a bunch?
Yeah, although honestly, most of the stories are about people who became hams returning from World War II after experience in the war with radios and telegraphy and things like that. So your dad had a really early experience, and that's just wonderful to hear because there's not a lot of that recorded. And that's just really great, Jane.
Well, thank you again, Jane, for taking the time and sharing your story with us. Really appreciate it. And, you know, this is, you know, we're talking about ham radio as a hobby, but it certainly is something that is really important in terms of communication tools for emergencies, Lisa. You know, can you give us an idea of what does that look like?
Sure, absolutely. People don't think of it, but cell phones need cell towers. And ham radios, especially radios that are HF or high frequency, don't need any other equipment other than a receiving ham radio positioned somewhere around the world to communicate. So, for instance, there was that hurricane in Puerto Rico, and to get communications to the mainland, they used HF radios as the initial way to talk. You know, eventually the government came in with satellite phones and stuff like that. But there's a way to communicate when cell phones are down, when power is down, and it can save lives, absolutely.
And so for listeners who might be interested, what does it take to become a ham operator? Do you need to take a test, do some training? You know, what does that look like?
Yeah, you take a test. There are three levels of license, and each level of license has a test. I'll say right now, the first level of license, the test is not made to keep people out of the hobby. It's pretty reasonable, and you're just learning things like the laws so you don't cause an international incident or something like that. And then if you want, you can take the second or third test, each of which gives you more privileges and more spots to transmit on the band.
And we heard a lot of Morse code earlier, and I got a chance to do a little tapping with the boys, if you will.
Yep.
Does any of the tests include knowing Morse code? Is that still part of the testing?
No, it used to be, but it's been dropped. So none of the licenses require Morse code. The license I have used to require it at 22 words a minute. And there is never a way I could have gotten this license with my Morse code skills.
Well, that's really good to hear. We've heard about Morse code. There's so much history that we learned when we were touring, with Skip and John and Peter. And they all talked about the museum providing, workshops and activities. What sort of activities and resources does the museum offer to hams?
Really, the big one is testing for the licenses. Every time that the museum hosts a swap meet, which is several times throughout the year, I and a bunch of other hams that are certified to give examinations will go into one of our rooms with candidates that want to get or upgrade their ham license and help them take the test, not help them on the test, but
good distinction.
Get them all set up and monitor their progress and then score their tests.
So with these resources available and also, this testing, it's active, would you say there's a need for more ham operators? Is this an area that you're actively looking for people? Is there a huge need for it?
Sure. We're actively looking for people because we think it's an amazing hobby and we want other people to have fun with it like we do. That's the big reason that we're actively looking for people, or at least I am. That's the pitch that I make when I'm giving museum guests a tour.
Well, and with that in mind, too, wanting to, create a more open space, I think, for more people to come in, because you talked about diversity in different ways within this community earlier, but the community could maybe stand to be diverse in other ways as well?
Yeah, I think we could improve our diversity a little bit in every way. Right now, everyone focuses on age because there are a lot of older hams, and cell phones, I think, have taken a lot of the newer hams off the market. But we could certainly use some diversity and inclusion.
And as you are more involved in the museum and these conversations are happening more, how many people have you seen turn on to the hobby after visiting the museum?
Oh, probably 25, 30 in the year and a half I've been there.
That's pretty sizable.
Yeah.
And are they all involved locally or?
Generally, just they'll drive to take the test from us for sometimes a distance, but they'll practice in their own location afterward.
And I know you shared a lot of your sort of background in terms of what got you interested in ham. Or is there something that surprised you during this experience? The fact that you're able to connect with people all around the world or meeting people locally, anything that jumps out to you?
I remember being young and using Morse code and getting a contact in Zagreb. And that just left such an impression. To this day, any time that I see a reference to Zagreb, I had one at work the other day. I'm just brought right back to that memory. Another little bit of a surprise. I took a break from ham radio for some years, or only did VHF volunteer work, and a whole new world of digital popped up that I didn't know about.
What was it about that digital world, you think?
I think that just finally computers had gotten powerful enough to handle some of the stuff that needs to go on to do that. And it's great stuff. It doesn't appeal to me as much because I want to just sit and talk with people.
Like we're doing right now.
Like we're doing right now. And the digital, though, is really great for poor conditions. So it'll make it when the power is low on the transmitter and the receiver is far away. So it can do some really neat stuff.
Well, and with you saying that, I was going to say, would that make it easier and perhaps safer when you are doing an emergency call or an emergency response?
So I volunteer for different kinds of events, and we're really stuck on a band called 2 Meters and doing voice, FM voice. And the reason we're stuck on it is it works just great. So I think it's going to be a lot to move us away from that.
And I just want to take another moment to shout out to some of the calls that we're getting this morning. We have Terry from Guilford, who has been a ham for 40 years. And Devin also called in to say he's met people from all walks of life. Thank you so much, Terry and Devin, for calling in and sharing with us your story. And it sounds like that's very similar to what you shared with us earlier, Lisa, you know, meeting people from all over the world. And in fact, before we went on air, you told us that you did put a call out on Reddit about today's segment. Can you share with us if you heard from your fellow hams?
Yeah, some of the Reddit folks had bulleted lists of things to talk about, and they were all detailed technical things,
all right.
So they weren't quite appropriate. Other people talked about bringing new hams into the hobby mm-hmm. and how the testing and licensing works, and some were just like, yay, well, I mean, you know, good press.
We love a yay. And I mean, this is very much related to I think, the what we're talking about today with you being a ham radio operator and being able to connect with people around the world. You know, the fact that you can put a call out on this internet platform today to ask for help or guidance, you know, how does that make you feel? What went through your mind when you did that?
Oh, that's great. You know, Reddit has been a great source of ham radio information for me. Hmm. And I look at it every day and learn about new stuff.
And you share with us earlier about this 100-plus foot antenna that you're building on in your backyard. Can you tell us what will that let you do?
Sure. That's going to be for a band called 80 meters, and it's going to be low to the ground, which invokes a situation called NVIS, near vertical incident sky wave. So you send the radio signal straight up into the atmosphere where it reflects down in a cone of 50 to 250 miles in diameter. And we used it at a rally I volunteer at where they race cars in the woods to get around a mountain.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's a really neat technology, and it's one that I happen to enjoy.
That sounds the most amazing nerding thing that I...
Yeah, totally.
We have about 4 million questions that we would love to follow up with you about. But any final thoughts you have with us, Lisa? You know, for a lot of people, I think this may or may not be the first time that they're hearing about ham radio or learning that they can be involved without any technical background. What would you hope our listeners take out from this conversation today?
Well, I hope some of the listeners look into ham as a hobby, at least. And there's a lot of good videos on YouTube, and ARRL.org has practice exams and good information about the hobby. So we're lucky to have them right in our backyard.
Well, and a quick shout out to the Radio and Communications Museum for taking us on a tour. And is there a place that listeners can go to if they want to come visit?
The webpage, and I think you guys are going to link to the webpage.
There will be more information on our website, sctpublic.org/where we live, as well as images from our tour. Lisa, you knew what I was going to say next, didn't you?
Yeah, maybe.
Everyone, you've been listening to Lisa Kirk, who's a vintage radio and communications museum volunteer and ham radio operator and enthusiast. Thank you so much, Lisa, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm Catherine Shen. Today's show is produced by Katie Pellico. Our technical producer is Dylan Reyes. Download Where We Live anytime on your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll be seeing you all on the radio.
When it's cold and gray outside, the streets are filled with snow. When you're drinking lots of coffee and the words begin to flow. When you're lonely and you got no place to go. I see you on the radio. Oh yeah. I see you on the radio. Oh Lord. Down on Collin Mack and Road. That's right. I see you on the radio. I'll meet you down on Asylum, across from St. Francis, past the conservatory, up the street from the seminary. You know, it's a very, very, very cool place to hang out. Yeah. It's cozy, like a Cracker Barrel. Yeah, we'll be laughing, talking, joking, talking about this and talking about that. Talk about everything as a matter of fact. Oh, yeah. Talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Wood.
on New Britain. Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah.
She'll want the radio.
On the radio, baby.